Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Carrie Wilt of The Well-Tended Life, and I am a speaker, writer, and heart cultivator who is on a mission to help you grow through anything. I am here today with my special guest, Rosie Allison, who has graciously agreed to be a part of this new series called Our Secret Garden Stories, which will feature many of those who have brought to life the new Secret Garden movie. I am so excited, I can't even see straight. So welcome, Rosie. Thank you for being a part of this today.
Thank you so much, Carrie, for having me on, and really just such a pleasure and a privilege to meet you for the first time. We've corresponded a little bit, but
yes.
We, Frances Hodgson Burnett, your kin, we're such admirers and lovers of her work.
Well, let's dig in really quick. Like, let's just get into the meat of it. Tell me who you are and what role you had within the making of the film.
Well, I'm a producer at a company, a British filmmaking company called Heyday Films. And I'm one of the producers of the film. I'm really the primary producer. I've produced with my boss David Heyman, who's produced many films like Gravity and Harry Potter, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But I suppose this was very particularly my special interest, and so this has been more my baby than his, although we're producing together.
I love it. Tell me about your original relationship with the book, The Secret Garden, because this is one of the very first stories you told me when we spoke on the phone, gosh, maybe 2 years ago? Has this process been this long?
Yeah, probably longer than that. I think we first started talking about it in 2014
Right.
So.
It was right after you announced that Colin Firth would be in the film. It was right around that time, and you hadn't begun filming yet. But I tell people about your relationship with The Secret Garden.
I can't remember what I told you, but I suppose I have quite a personal relationship with The Secret Garden, really, just because I myself, when I was 8, I was sent away to boarding school in Yorkshire. So I ended up in one of these, you know, big old strange mansions in the North Yorkshire Moors, my own Misselthwaite Manor. And I had lovely parents, and I wasn't an orphan, but my parents were very distant. You know, they were away, and I was away at boarding school and not seeing them for a long time. And yes, it was while I was there that I saw the film, the black and white 1949 film, which I loved, the sort of creeping around in corridors and finding the garden. You know, the place where I was watching it was wilder than that. And but that drove me to the book, and it's inseparable for me from the experience of being a child sent away to this big old house in Yorkshire. So it has a very strange relationship with me. Even stranger, really, looking back, is that even when I was that age, I always loved movies, and I always sort of thought I wanted to make films. And it's very strange to find many years later it going full circle and me going back to a story which echoed my own childhood. And indeed, we ended up going back and filming quite a lot of some key scenes of the film in that very in that house and in the grounds of.
Really?
Yes. So the sort of the grounds of Misselthwaite Manor and the big plain out front and the gardens out the back where she runs around before she finds the garden, that's all filmed at the school. I mean, it's no longer a school, where I was running around when I was between 8 and 12. So it's very close to my heart, obviously, in a strange way.
Isn't it amazing how you were equipped for the role that you're in today? You know, so long ago, those seeds were planted. and how you're able to use them.
Well, absolutely, you know, truly, because there are many pains and griefs with the whole being packed off to boarding school and all the, you know, emotional deprivations of that experience, which many people have written about over the years. It's not something I recommend and not something I did to my own children, but it was a very beautiful place, and I did, I built a very strong bond with nature at that time, which has continued to be a great solace in my life. And in time of trouble, I have to go for a walk. You know, that's where I go. I have to go for a walk in beautiful scenery of some kind.
Oh my gosh. I remember hanging up the phone the first time you told me this story. And I turned and told my husband, and I was like, oh, she's the right one. She's the right one to steward this story, because she feels it all the way through. And I just knew that it was in good hands with you. So
that's really lovely to hear.
I love that story. So talk to me about, first of all, our listeners are from all walks of life, and chances are they may not even understand like what the difference is between like a producer and a director. And so like, how did you become a part of the film? And then kind of really, what was your role within that, mm-hmm. if that makes sense?
Well, there were so many different aspects to being a producer, and they're different on every film. I would be what we would call a creative producer, from the point of view that we had the idea, let's make The Secret Garden. And so then we reached out to writers to see if they'd be interested in adapting. And then, and in this case, the first writer we reached out to was Jack Thorne, who we knew had a lovely, a very close connection with his inner child, and a lovely deep lyrical poetic soul. And luckily he was our first approach, and he immediately said, I'd love to do this. So then we worked with Jack on the script. And then when that felt ready, I mean, we then searched for a director. And Mark Munden, our director, he'd been somebody I'd been meeting for over years and trying to persuade him to do different projects. And he'd turned me down on various things, actually. But he's a very particular director who has a very keen eye, and everything he does has an amazing vision to it. And he also goes very deep in the psychology and the emotional depth of the performances with his actors. And he's not at all thought of as doing things for children. So he tends to do darker, edgier, more adult things. But I had remembered that he'd been bereaved at a young age. He'd lost his father as a boy. And also, obscurely, I'd also remember that his mother had been sent to boarding school in India. And so she'd had a sort of Raj childhood. And so the combination, you know, made me think, well, perhaps Mark would be interested in this. And he'd actually worked with Jack very successfully on a television series. So we sent it to him, and we're thrilled that he responded. And so so then that becomes, you know, that becomes the little team.
The core.
The writer and director, and then it grows from there, and you you search for your production designer, your composer, your costume designer. We worked very closely together as a creative team. The searching, we went on this long search for the right places, for finding the gardens. Obviously, I didn't want to force on Mark Munden, this location, which had been such an important part of my childhood. But I showed him pictures, and he said, yeah, I'd like to see that. And we drove up to Yorkshire, because we knew we wanted to film in Yorkshire. And to my joy, he fell in love with this place, which had been a part of my childhood. And so he was really happy to film there and make that the sort of base grounds of Misselthwaite. It took us a while to find the exterior. We found the exterior finally in a in two places in the Midlands, two different houses, which we've sort of used the facades and placed them somewhere else, but to create our Gothic mansion of Misselthwaite. But what can I say? A producer, very often you begin with the idea and it grows around that. But quite often films begin with a writer coming up with the idea or a director, commissioning a writer. In this particular instance, it was, that we make family films often at Heyday. It's something we're interested in. And The Secret Garden was always very dear and close to my heart. And to be honest, we probably would have got to it earlier, but there was always this report that Guillermo del Toro was going to make The Secret Garden. But then nothing seemed to be happening. And I'd emerged from making a film called Testament of Youth. And it just seemed like, where is The Secret Garden? It's not being made. So why don't we take the plunge and try and make it?
Because it's been, has it been 20 years since the last, since the Warner Brothers?
27 years. So
there's a whole generation who has missed it if they haven't read it. That's, I think for me, that's the most exciting part about this is, some of that generation, their mamas. And daddies are, they're already kind of past that young age, excuse me. And to get this new, last 25 years worth of kids and adults alike.
Yeah, that's what I felt. I mean, there have been several versions. I really loved the MGM black and white one, which was a bit closer to Rebecca and its sort of, dark expressionist look. But I thought the 93 one had a real beauty to it. But it still didn't feel to me like a really definitive one had been made. I didn't feel it was like remaking The Sound of Music. And it felt more like it's, revisiting a Shakespeare play, revisiting The Winter's Tale and doing a different production of it and for a new generation. And and I feel it's just such an enduring story and that it doesn't age really. The metaphors just ring true for everybody, whatever age, that, that finding your, lost inner space and a closed heart, letting it open and heal, is tied up with the metaphors of nature, and it never goes away. So, but we did wonder about, should we make this a contemporary story, and that didn't quite work. It did feel like, the past needed to be another country still a bit, because that whole thing of Colin locked up in his room and it felt like there were obstacles to the isolation of the story, and that didn't feel we could bring alive and with any plausibility
in today.
You've
already told us what brought you the most joy within that. What are you most grateful for from this experience?
I don't know if I have I told you about what brought me the most joy.
You did. You said watching. You said watching others. And unless you have a different answer, there can be lots of joy. We don't have to limit the joy.
There are many joys. I've talked about what a pleasure it was to see how inspired the different collaborators got. That was incredible. People really did find their own inner children with this and were inspired and their imaginations came alive and they had they really enjoyed doing it. I could see that. I think as a whole team, we had an amazing experience going around these gardens. It was just inspiring. We spent 5 weeks roaming the country, it was sunny every day. We didn't have any rain. We had this heat wave. So we had blissful weather all the time. And the combination of blue skies, amazing gardens, and children and a dog, it made for, you know, the whole crew really, really enjoyed it. There was a sort of eternal summer feeling about it, which was a great joy. So that was amazing. I remember one particular, I mean, obviously as a producer, it's very stressful depending on the weather. I remember one particular day, which is when we were filming the scene in which Archibald is reunited with his son in the garden. That was a scene we shot in this beautiful garden called Iford Manor near Bath. There was Colin Firth already and Eden, his son, already to, and the garden setting just glorious. And, you know, the nerves and anxiety of will it be a glorious sunny day or won't it be? And I remember us preparing and it was a beautiful weather and you know, sitting at the side and watching it and just feeling so happy that here we were. And the sun was shining, Colin was there, the kids were there. And I remember emailing a friend just in the joy of the moment of seeing this glorious scene and everything just going perfectly. And that was a happy moment.
My goodness. With each project, I'm sure you learned something out of it, some life lessons, some bit of growth or personal experience. Did you have anything like that come out of this project?
Well, I suppose, you know, one had to be philosophical. Always in films, you have this pre-production period when suddenly it turns out you don't have as much money in the budget as you all thought you did, and you know, you have to work out what to cut and what you can't do, and you know, there was quite there were suggestions of should we have less gardens, should we, you know, consolidate the gardens, not go to so many places. And part of that was the gamble with the weather, and the stress was the, well, you know, we can afford this if the weather is good. And I suppose in a foolhardy way, we did go ahead with all our best laid plans and just hope for the best with the weather. And we thought, well, if it rains, we'll make it work. If we, you know, we'll just make it work, and it did work. And so I suppose it was just that trusting to faith and optimism and deciding to pursue the dream, and hope for the best, and trust that we could adjust and adapt, and then it working out fine. That was a helpful thing to build on, because it gives you hope for the future. You think, well, let's try and it'll probably work somehow.
Well, and that's, for me, that's the deepest message of The Secret Garden. It's just, you know, always learning to operate in that hope mode. You know, and you know, the garden is the one that shows us that, you know, even if it does rain, you know, the flowers will bloom again. Even if fall comes, you know, and the leaves go away, you know, spring will come again. And it's an amazing lesson from the garden. Mm-hmm.
On a more personal level, I would say that, you know, I explained that the story had certain kind of personal resonances for me, because, you know, I was a socially privileged but slightly emotionally, but more emotionally deprived classic child of a certain sector of British society, sent off to boarding school, aged eight, very distant relations, relationship from my parents. And so it was a very healing experience for me going back to make this film about childhood and about trying to understand what had gone on with my own my own parents in that time. And in some ways, this is a story about children learning to forgive their parents. Mm-hmm. And so I went through, during the whole process of examining this story, when I read it as a child, all I saw was the children. And as an adult, I came back and I saw the children confused and not understanding the griefs of the adults. And as I mentioned before, we wove in this extra strand for Mary and her mother. And in the book, Mary's mother just vanishes. And we built in a sense that Mary's, Mary's feckless mother perhaps wasn't feckless, but was perhaps depressed and withdrawn from her because of grief and other reasons. And in many ways that actually mirrored, my own having been sent away and, my absent mother, that was her own battles that she was fighting. And so it was rather lovely for me to make a film in which Mary came to make peace with the ghost of her mother. And we started making this film probably a year after the death of my mother, or we started the process of engaging with this. Mm. And I'd very much made peace with my mother, and I'd understood by the end all the things that had stopped her from being present when we were young. But it was a lovely way it's a lovely story to make peace with a mother who'd been absent in my childhood, but I hadn't understood at the time, but later I understood. And I suppose I would hope that it is a film which all sorts of children will sit down and watch and gently have a sense of the complexity of adult lives just beyond their vision and understanding, but to try and empathize and understand adult grief, even if they can't do anything about it.
I can also, The Secret Garden, because of its reach across generations, I imagine the daughter and the mother and the grandmother all sitting on a couch together, and the child having the experience that you just discussed, but then the mother sitting there having that aha moment that all mothers do of young children of, oh, this is what my mother must have felt in the difficulties of raising a child or whatever it is. But being able to see that, being able to look now to that next generation with kinder eyes and more empathy and more understanding, I think what you have planted there is going to do some good healing in other lives as well.
Well, I mean, it's on the one hand, it is a story for children, but it's certainly a complicated old story full of grief and darkness and, Archibald projecting his illness and depression on his son and Mary emotionally damaged by this, difficult relationship with her mother. And so there are all these broken people. So it's dark territory for a children's story, really. But then very often children's stories are about, dark stories which have to be overcome. So that's the essence of this. But what I love about it is that although it's a story, a children's story, it is also a story about childhood. And so I do hope that there will be lots of adults who tune into this sort of lost domain of their childhood and look back and find something there for themselves.
Hey friends, I know you're loving my conversation with Rosie, but I wanted to chime in and tell you that she is not only a mom and a talented director, she's also a published writer. Her book, The Very Thought of You, is set in England in the year 1939. The world is on the brink of war. As Hitler prepares to invade Poland, thousands of children are evacuated from London to escape the impending Blitz. Torn from her mother, 8-year-old Anna Sands is relocated with other children to a large Yorkshire estate, which has been opened up to evacuees by Thomas and Elizabeth Ashton, an enigmatic, childless couple. Soon, Anna gets drawn into their unraveling relationship, seeing things that are not meant for her eyes, and finding herself part witness and part accomplice to a love affair with unforeseen consequences. It's a story of longing, loss, complicated loyalties, combining a sweeping narrative with subtle psychological observations. The Very Thought of You is not just a love story, but a story about love. Vogue UK says, it's one of those books you're likely to remember all of your life. And the book pages says, it's for readers of The Orphan Train and Potato Peel Society. Comes basically not just a story of love, but a story of loss, one whose voice will touch even the coldest of hearts. Search for it today on Amazon or look in the show notes for a direct link. And now let's get back to the rest of our chat with Rosie.
One hope I have for this is that, you know, I first discovered this when I was 8 and I was a lonely child. And it spoke to me, and I want us to have made a film that is played and replayed, and I hope has a life, and that I hope, you know, it will reach many children who are sitting on their own, feeling a bit lonely, a bit abandoned, you know, anybody who's feels like an outsider, who feels marginalized, who feels emotionally neglected. I feel this is a story that can speak to them and help them and give them hope. And so that's, you know, I sort of hope we put it out into the world and it has enough credibility that people keep playing it, and then it will naturally reach who it's really meant for, which is, you know, slightly lost, lonely people.
I always say that, I try to, when I'm done speaking, I always name everyone honorary secret gardeners for their role. And you are definitely an honorary secret gardener, because what you're doing is you are planting seeds in the hearts of these kids that will continue to grow and bloom for a lifetime. Because here's the truth is of what you said is that, everybody needs a secret garden that they can go to and feel safe and loved and accepted. And what I believe Frances created in that book was that safe place, that story that when things get hard, you can crawl up into your imagination, into the secret garden, and know that there's hope and a future.
Yeah, no, I agree. Exactly. Yeah. No, she gave everybody something very special to hang on to.
Thank you for playing your part in all of this.
Well, thank you.
Okay, friends, I'm breaking in again. Not normally my norm, but this was not a normal interview. You're about to hear me wrap up this interview part, but there was so much more that happened before the interview even started that I didn't want you to miss it. But I'm also here to give you a big giant warning. If you have not seen the Secret Garden new movie yet, I would suggest waiting until you see it to come back and listen to the second part of this interview. Not that there are giveaways or spoilers or anything like that. It's just a more intimate conversation about the film and why we love it and behind the scenes things that if you have seen it, it will make a whole lot more sense to you. So I just wanted to give you that big warning. When I wrap this interview up, there is still another 30 minutes of amazing conversation after this. So stay tuned. But if you want to, I would totally suggest watching the movie first. That's it.
This has been such a treat to get to hear all of your inside scoops, but also just the care in which you have treated the Secret Garden is fully recognized by me and my family. But I do believe that the world who loves the Secret Garden already will also see that care with which you took to bring this story to this next generation. So thank you so much.
Well, fingers crossed. You know, we've certainly really tried our best and we love it, you know, and we've taken a few liberties, which I hope you will understand. And let's hope that, you know, it speaks to, it, you know, there will be people who have, everybody has their own secret garden. We've tried our best, but it's certainly a really beautiful and profound work that deserves to be remembered and retold and kept alive. And so let's hope this film will keep the flame alive for a really beautiful and special book.
Rosie, thank you so much for sharing your part of the Secret Garden story. Thank you everyone who is watching this on YouTube or listening on podcast. And until next time, everybody, blessings and blooms, y'all.
And as promised, it is not over. Here is the rest of the interview before the interview even began.
Hello, hello.
Hello, we meet again. I'm so sorry to interrupt with you. How are you?
I'm great. Truly, do you need more time? This is not a big deal.
I don't at all. Now I'm just longing to hear what you made of the film. I mean, it's a hard one to ask because, you know the book so well and there are changes and so forth, but were you able to make peace with the adaptation? And
Oh, there's no peace to be made. I was walking in with open arms. I have dealt with what you are going to be dealing with a million times over, which is the, I call her the angry book lady. The people who hold so tight onto those words. So I have had to, answer those questions a million times about, you know, aren't you upset about the changes? And, you know, Frances wouldn't have been. Frances knew what it was like to turn a book into a play and then a play into a book again. And she knew that new characters came to the forefront. So I have never held fast to the Secret Garden, except for in, of course, the message, right? What your team has done. First of all, I know I will never be able to come up with the appropriate words to tell you how I feel about it, but it is the pure essence of the Secret Garden throughout, and I think made better. The pieces that you all chose to draw out, it's fantastic. I will struggle. There's no way for me to say how pleased I am. And I believe that even the people who have seen The Secret Garden will love it, and or know The Secret Garden book like the back of their hands. I believe that they too will fall in love with it. The people who have never heard of The Secret Garden are going to connect with it as well.
Oh, I'm so pleased. I'm so pleased because we love it. I mean, we think it's, you know, it's very pure yes, I sort of feel you can, you know, leave your life behind and enter into this world and go on a journey with Mary. And she's pretty amazing, don't you think, young Dixie?
Oh,
she's a wonderful actress for letting you inside her soul and the intelligence.
She's brilliant. She's absolutely brilliant. And the state of the movie, the way it seamlessly flows from this, what would you say? Like a dreamy imagination state to flashbacks and then back into reality. The movie just like undulates there and goes back and forth in this way that One moment you feel like you're in a dream, the next minute you're snapped back to reality, and it's...
I'm so pleased you like that.
It never stops.
That was something we really wanted, the real fluidity between the inner and outer worlds, and that you're with... It's very much Mary's story from her point of view, but it's a more, I hope, subjective and immersive version, adaptation, than in comparison with some of the earlier versions, so that just feel this inner world and her imaginative connection to nature around her, and so yes, memories, dreams, glimpses, and the sort of concurrent inner world and ghosts of the hauntings, if you like, but within the landscape and the house, yeah. But that's what's so great about the story, that it's all there.
Yeah. I believe that I saw Frances in a new way through Mary, and reflected within this story. It was like, there were flashes that I was like, it was almost a more personal version of who I believe Frances was. Within Mary, that storyteller that is not real, it's not the book, but the way you've drawn it out and made her really that narrator of the story that was there before, but now it's Mary. That was Frances her whole life. She was the narrator of everything that was going on around her, and she absolutely told stories everywhere she went. And her brothers really disliked it and almost bullied her. And anytime she would tell a story, they would kind of put her off. You imagine having a sister who jibber jabbered all the time and told mm-hmm. stories. I mean, just like we probably all did, we'd be like, oh, please be quiet. But I imagine, I saw Mary's face when that boy, told her, oh, those are, basically just silly stories.
Just a boy story, yes.
I know Frances felt that growing up, for sure. So there were all these little, like, tiny nuggets that I was like,
took that a little bit from A Little Princess and the sense that, that she was such a great storyteller, but that was part of Mary as well. It felt that she obviously was a child with imagination, and
yes.
that was, she's not just a prickly girl, entitled girl. She's sort of redeemed right from the start by the fact that we're moved by her imaginative capabilities. And but that is within the book, there is moments when she's... But it's not quite as marked as The Little Princess, but it felt legitimate, as they were both clearly Frances in some way, to sort of draw them together.
I love it. Oh my goodness. Okay.
I love that quote. I've written it down.
Frances. The between the lines of every story.
That's it. I love that. I love that quote. And that was the sort of license we took a little bit, the sense of reading between the lines and finding a few other things. So a very clear example of that really was that we did weave in quite a lot more about Mary's relationship with her mother. Mm-hmm. And obviously in the book, she's feckless and she dies on the first page, whatever, and she seems to be uninterested in Mary. And then she vanishes a bit, but I felt that there was a sort of a gap there, and that there was a space to explore, this poor damaged child who's been damaged by feeling emotionally neglected, and that very often those upper class mothers who seem to just ignore you, they had their own problems and you just couldn't see it. And so we just wanted to unpack that a little bit and weave that through so that she was able to make peace with the ghost of her mother. So that is an extra thread really that we brought into the picture, but I hope it was legitimate.
I loved that part, and I loved I loved the fact that it reminds us all that even our perceptions of reality aren't always the full reality. Mm-hmm. Mary and, and Colin both were able to better understand their fuller picture by hearing both sides of mm-hmm. their parents who were walking through immense grief. Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating story. It's so rich, the whole story, but the whole idea that these children who make their own little Garden of Eden without the parents, and yet part of it is about them learning to forgive, to break the cycle of family groups, but also to forgive and understand their parents, really, too.
Yeah, and that grief is something that doesn't look the same on everybody. Mm-hmm. I think even in this pandemic, I'm learning to just be empathetic and understand that not everybody's dealing with all of this the same. It doesn't, the way you deal with it is different from the way someone else deals with it. And grief comes in many forms. And you see it throughout the book. Every character. And the movie that clearly every character in the movie has dealt with grief and they're all doing it differently.
And it's rather lovely having Colin Firth in the film because he's such an emotional actor and, he can carry a whole hinterland with him of a deep reservoir of feeling. So although he doesn't appear a huge amount, I hope he has quite a power and a presence in the film.
I think he does. It's amazing. I think that's the other thing that I loved and was pleasantly surprised by was that really this film is about the children. That it is really centered around those three. At first I longed a little bit for, a Ben the Gardener and, they carry it. And the message that pulls out of that, I think, is stronger because it's almost like a distilled down version, if that mm-hmm. makes sense, to where you were able to go deeper, it felt, into yes. those characters.
Yes, yes, I'm sorry, because Ben is a favorite character for many, isn't he?
And yes.
Yes, we sort of winnowed it down to Mrs. Medlock as a sort of obstacle to the garden, and then there is that more radical change that we made, which I don't know how you felt about it. I'm sure it won't be for everyone, but where we have the fire, but our logic was that there's so much connective tissue between the Secret Garden and Jane Eyre. And there's so much the sense of, the plucky, clever, plain girl who goes off to the big old house in Yorkshire and meets this broken man, whether it's Archibald or Mr. Rochester. And then the whole place has to kind of burn down to be healed again. And there was a sort of we felt that maybe there needed an escalation, and we drew from Jane Eyre for that moment to have a burn down before a rebirth.
Well, and that's nature. I mean, really, that's what happens in nature all the time, is the burning down before the growth can happen. And I felt like it felt natural as far as the arc of the story goes and the buildup and the... of course, you go, oh, well, that's not in the film, but then you go, oh yeah, but this is a great way to wrap it up and also cause that moment of clarity for Archibald Craven to really, snap out of it and go and find those things that are most important to him. And he does that, so.
Yes, because I suppose we took a few liberties, because in the story, obviously, he's off wandering, isn't he? And he hears the call, which I do love, But we just focused, we kept him in the house and we kept the sort of unity of time and place a bit tighter, really, to...
Well, and you did the call, but it was in a way, it was in that ghostly way. So it's, that's what I love, is that the essence is all there. It's just done in this new way that you haven't... You haven't seen before, and it'll stretch your mind and it'll stretch your imagination. And I know fans will love it. And I knew that I know the new fans will love it as well.
We're very excited about the garden. I mean, some people may prefer the smaller walled garden, but there was something, you know, about getting into this place and it feeling more boundless and wild. And you know, you can't quite know where it begins or ends. And we did go to all these amazing gardens to
how many gardens did you end up having to piece together?
I haven't got a number in my head, but I can quickly list them mentally. So Duncan Park, Helmsley Walled Garden, Fountains Abbey, Bodnant Gardens in North Wales, the Forest of Dean in Puzzlewood in the Forest of Dean, Iford Manor in Somerset, Treebar Gardens in Cornwall, Woodhall Estate in Hertfordshire, and then the Indian house we filmed in a place called Abbotsbury Gardens in Dorset. I think that's all. But anyway, it was a big trek around, you know, every corner of the UK. But we really wanted to find some inspiring places, and you know, when I'm reading Frances Hodgson Burnett's memoir of her childhood and of her the two houses, the house before her father died, where there was a beautiful garden, and then the sort of slightly derelict garden that she wandered into. She's very much talking about how once you're into this place, it feels huge and wondrous and forever. So there was clearly a sense in which she was aware of the subjective power of a childhood's imagination extending a garden and creating.
And the way you all wove that into, I mean, you wove it into wallpaper, into blankets, into when y'all see this, you're just going to, your mind's going to be blown, because all of a sudden you'll think something is something and then it'll turn into something else. And well, it's just, yeah, we love, and then you're like, oh, it's the imagination.
Yeah, our production designer was really had such a joyous time, you know, weaving the garden into the wallpaper in the house and trying to make it all very inwoven, really. That sort of, so, you know, when you watch it again, you'll see that there's lots and lots of design details to find there of what you don't notice at first that's hidden in the corners of the room. And then you finally, because we didn't want it to be one of those houses which was just lots of dark paneling. We wanted it to have full of color and a sense that it had been a joyous place that was sort of dormant and closed down, and that gradually more light comes into it and it begins to come more alive until you begin to see that the garden itself is sort of inscribed in the walls. So there's lots of inwoven metaphors in this story which were just a joy to visualize.
It's amazing. I cannot wait for people to see this.
One of the questions you asked in the little document was, you know, what was part of the joy of it? And actually, one of the real joys was that I could really see how it excited, how the story and the world excited and inspired different people. And for example, our lovely costume designer, Michelle Clapton, when she came to see us, she was so excited. She's a wonderful costume designer who's done the Game of Thrones costumes and won many awards and so forth. But it was just the imaginative quality of the story, and that she wanted to create all these costumes which evolved. And yes. So Mary's, you know, moss would start to grow on the coat, and butterflies would emerge out of a dress, and flowers would start to to grow out. So she, you know, she came up with these evolving costumes. So she just, you know, her team handmade them all. And it was, she was, you know, she just had such a blissful time designing Mary's costumes. And our production designer was so excited about, in, you know, weaving together all the inner and outer worlds, and our director and writer obviously as well. And, you know, there were just so many people, puppeteers, getting really excited about how we could make the ferns shake and shiver around the river, and how we could do the puppets and this, you know, the cinematographer. They were all just so excited about creating this children's world, and people really had a lot of creative joy making this.
Oh, and the way that the foliage and the flowers are a part of the humans in the story, and even the non-humans, the animals in the story, like you said, you know, I noticed the ferns shaking with Colin shaking. Mm-hmm. You know, they were almost like they were taking on the emotion and the pain in a way that is, I mean, I don't know who is sitting in a room figuring all this out, but it is, your mind is going to be blown when you watch it. Everybody, your mind is going to be blown. And I do think it is a movie that you should watch. And I think that's actually one of the, watch over and over and over again, because you, it is like, it's a giant seek and find, or a hidden pictures almost, of sorts, because there are so many things. I've watched it twice now, and the little details that you notice just add to the mystery and the magic and the, and all of it.
Well, I'm so pleased to feel that, because we really wanted it to have all these layers and mystery and magic, and that sense of, you know, this house full of secrets and mysteries that gradually reveal and unfolds. But particularly that just inspiration of our relationship with nature, and you know, it's amazing how few films actually do try and tackle immersing us in the natural world and showing its inspiration, but we wanted to have a garden which was responsive and did seem to echo and reflect.
Yes.
So, you know, our inspiration was very much real gardens. We didn't want to make it fake with CGI, so we have used that sparingly, and we went to these really, you know, inspiring places. But then we have subtly used, as we say, you know, sometimes we use some puppeteers, and sometimes we enhance with some visual effects to try and give a sense of nature having a sort of symbiotic relationship with the children, and being sad when they're sad, or
right.
Joyous when they're, or shivering when they're cold, or, you know, and that sort of that responsive echoing between their imagination and the garden around them felt, I hope, something that hasn't really been done in earlier versions of The Secret Garden. So, and that feels very central to Francis's understanding and vision of what the magic of the pantheistic spirit of the garden is. But
it's, I mean, we could talk about it all day, Laura.
And we really could talk about it all day long. But it really is over this time. The podcast is finished. And y'all, I had so much fun talking with Rosie today about the new film. I know that this conversation will make you want to go back and watch the movie again and again because of all the yummy things you may have missed. I want to encourage you, of course, to go see the Secret Garden film. But also, I want you to check out her other work, The Light Between Oceans, Paddington, and The Boy in the Striped Pajamas. And her book, of course, The Very Thought of You. And remember, all month long on the podcast, we're featuring interviews with many of those who've helped bring the new Secret Garden movie to life. So stay tuned here for next week's episode with Isis David, who plays Martha, the sassy housemaid of Misselthwaite Manor. Now make sure that you're following The Well-Tended Life on Instagram and Facebook, and subscribe today to our podcast and YouTube channels by the same name so you don't miss a thing. And until next time, y'all, blessings and blooms.